Hello and welcome back to the Careless Talk Climbing Podcast with me, Sam Pryor, and Aidan Roberts.
Hello.
We're getting better. Joining us this week is Buster Martin, who is one of Britain's best sport climbers. He's recently climbed Action Direct and joins Alex Magos as the only person to have climbed both Action Direct and Hubble. As well as that, he's a coach and a sort of climbing trainer, and we talk quite a lot about that as well. So we get a lot of his thoughts about rock climbing and also training and coaching climbers.
Great chat with Buster. And in addition, I'd also like to thank our new patrons. We've had some new patrons, and the support is really helpful for us, helps us keep this show on the road. If you're interested in becoming a patron, it really helps us out, and it will also give you access to an app called Discord, and on this app you can message us, and we have a series of categories of message boards or something, and basically we will let you know who's our next guests are going to be. So we get some questions from patrons, and they can pitch questions to upcoming guests. And what we're looking to do down the line as well is just some, quite often in this point where we're like recording the intro, me and Sam will chat for quite a long time about some, like something happening within climbing right now. So we thought maybe people would find those interesting as well sometimes. So we might start releasing some episodes where it's just discussions between the two of us. And so if you're interested in certain discussion points as well, you can reach out to us on Discord and propose those. Trying to make it a bit more interactive with the climbing community. If you'd like to help us out, and the link will be in the show notes.
Thanks for listening.
Well, first, introducing you, Buster. My first ever climbing coach was a guy called Liam Halsey, who
Hitman.
He moved up north to the Lake District from London. I don't know if he'd actually lived in, but he used to coach in London at Westway. And yeah. I think it was just at the time, I think when he moved up, he just finished competitions or like taken a step back from comps. Or maybe like that was kind of in the process where you started doing less anyway. But I remember when he moved up, he was like, when he was discussing about doing some coaching, you know, you get testimonials and he's like, I've coached this person and this person. And it was, he said he'd done some coaching with you and Molly and where your world rankings were at the time. And I was nothing special at the time. To even like consider having a world ranking was miles ahead. That was like my first ever, that was the first time I'd heard of you, but I then quite quickly got into competitions, but just as you left, so we never actually crossed over. But you were in youth competitions for a while, right? And predominantly the lead comps.
I don't think the bouldering international bouldering competitions actually existed when I was competing, so I was mostly doing the lead competitions. I think I started in around 2009, made it onto the team a few years later after like trying for quite a while. I was really psyched. That was a big goal of mine. And then I competed in the international competition for a few years.
And then you never made that transition to seniors?
Yeah, I think I ended up stopping climbing for a few years. It wasn't like I like suddenly hated climbing and I quit one day. It kind of slowly happened over time. So it was less and less psyched. And I think part of that was maybe I didn't have the purest motivation for competitions. I think I had a very sort of modern entry to climbing, working with lots of coaches, like a very an indoor wall bred climber. And that was sort of just what you were expected to go and do, competitions. And I think what I really loved was like going rock climbing and competing against myself rather than other people. So I think that killed my motivation a bit. And then I also just spent some time like enjoying being a teenager and enjoying other aspects of life as well.
Yeah. So like how old were you when you sort of stepped back from climbing?
I think I would have been around 16 or 17.
And then what made you kind of find it again?
So I'd always wanted to go to Hampi and to Rocklands.
Yeah.
And when I finished school, I decided to go on a bouldering trip. I hadn't really been climbing for maybe 2 or 3 years. And I went to Hampi and had like a really amazing time, like was sort of climbing without any expectations or no numbers and just going climbing with like a very different group of people to who I was climbing with in competitions. So it really brought back the like essence of just going rock climbing, which was really nice. And then it wasn't a few years after that when I actually got more psyched into the performance sort of aspect again.
Yeah. And like when you kind of got psyched for rock climbing, you came back. Did you entertain the prospect of jumping back into competitions?
Yeah, so I think I'd been doing a little bit of rock climbing, but I wasn't taking it very seriously. And I had that trip to Hampi and Rocklands and then stopped again for a few months. And it was only when I did another rock climbing trip where I think at the start of it, I was climbing like 6B or something in Sayuz and having an absolute nightmare, like really scared above the bolt. I went to watch Jim and Molly competing in the World Cup in Briançon, and I'd climbed with them a lot before because we all sort of grew up in and around London. And I saw how much they'd improved and where they'd gone with their climbing. And I found it like very inspiring to see how strong they'd got. And that was what got me motivated to start taking it seriously. And then I was like interested in the comps. I think I did one BLCC. It didn't go that well. I was still psyched. But the thing with the lead comps is there just isn't any lead competitions in the UK. So I think it wasn't for another year. There was a BLCC and then just other things got in the way, and I got more psyched for rock climbing. And I think I probably made the right decision there to stick with the rock climbing. I think it's something I'm a bit more motivated by.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty self-aware age 16 or whatever to acknowledge your feeling like your relationship with competitions wasn't the healthiest anyway, and actually taking a step back from that. But then to also come back to it without the competition mindset, I feel like that's something, maybe the break helped with that. But I feel lots of people who do competitions and then go outside, I find it's quite hard to detach from that competition, like, outlook on climbing. I definitely had that when I stopped competing and started climbing outside more. Very like result focus of success to top this, failure if you don't kind of thing. And it definitely took a little while to be like, yeah, I think you described it as like the essence of climbing, or like kind of a bit of passion for like the movement itself. That trip to Rocklands, I think I might have been there that same season. I remember because the last time I'd heard of you climbing when you were younger, and like I kind of wasn't really climbing, but you actually had a pretty good trip, right?
Yeah, I think before that trip, I'd only climbed up to 7B plus Boulder. And then I climbed my first 8B, the Vice, which was...
Oh, wow, that's not bad.
Yeah, it was pretty mind-blowing because I almost, even when I was competing, I never thought I would like climb that hard on the boulders. It wasn't like a grade which I'd ever considered on or ever tried before. So it was cool to have that process out in the Rocklands.
Wow, that's quite a major jump, especially after a diet of not climbing. That's that's not going to inspire the folks at home.
Yeah, so go away having climbed 7B plus and expect to climb an 8B.
I think that time off really fixed my attitude and made me a better climber in a way. I think it made me much more relaxed. And even though I had all that time off, ultimately, I think it's without it, I maybe wouldn't be climbing at all right now. If I'd have just pushed on, then I don't think I would be here right now. I maybe would have like fully fallen out of love with it. So I think it was maybe a good thing I had a bit of time off and learned to appreciate other parts of life and come back with a bit more of a balanced perspective.
Yeah. What were you doing in that time off? Did you find other sports, or were you just being a little tearaway?
Yeah, pretty much. Mostly just drinking beer. I mean, I went to the gym a little bit and a little bit of cycling on my road bike, but yeah, I didn't do much. I was really into photography and I was doing some photography work and working studios, that kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, because people who remember you from back in the youth days say that you used to be a little wild as a kid.
Yeah, I definitely had a bit of attitude about me. I think I've calmed down a bit now.
But I do wonder, like, as a kid, being a little bit on the wild side as it was, is that kind of the wrong style of kid to be throwing into competitions, which is only going to exacerbate that? If you had a bit of troubles controlling your emotions as normally.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that one. I think definitely even now I get a little bit frustrated, like with rock climbing. Like just yesterday I was like throwing my shoes all over the place and shouting. But something I sort of realized recently was I didn't actually care that much, but it was more that other people think that you're meant to care about these things. So it's like,
I
often have like quite a lot of times when I'm not climbing and I come back to climbing and I'm not climbing very well, and I would maybe fall off something easy, like fall off a 7A, and people would look at you like, oh, is he not angry? Like, you're not meant to fall off that. And then maybe I would feel like, oh, I'm meant to be frustrated about this. And I've sort of realized that, yeah, I don't actually care. It's more maybe other people think you're meant to be, feel some sort of emotion about your failure about that. And maybe that's made it come out of me sometimes.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. Like, as in, like, when you actually properly engage with how you feel, it's not always.
Yeah.
The reaction isn't always authentic. That's cool.
So at which point during all this did you get psyched on training? And then, like, you got such a special interest in training that you then took that into the coaching? Because there must be some point you got really into the training first, surely.
Yeah, I think I was totally obsessed with training from the start. So I think I was writing about this recently. I wrote my first training plans back in 2010 or 11 as like a part of a GCSE project. And I used Molly, my training partner at the time, as a sort of case study for that. So straight away, I was really into like reading about training. I was reading stuff from Gresham, Stephen McClure in the magazines. And there wasn't that much online, but I remember reading like the Moon blog, Beastmaker blogs, and just as much information as I can. I was like trying to take it all in. And my mum was also a personal trainer. So there was always a lot of discussion at home about training, a lot of textbooks lying around the place. So I think that was, I think that influenced my interest into training quite a lot. And then I initially started that just to help my own climbing. And it's only in the last few years where I started coaching.
Mm. You studied sports science for a while as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I studied sports therapy.
You actually have some research to apply. It's easy to be anecdotal, isn't it? But
yeah,
a bit of science does no harm.
Yeah, for sure.
But did you find that any of the stuff you kind of were learning then is the stuff you actually use, or do you just now look for your own studies? And
yeah, I mean, I think the thing that university taught me, I think, was more how to read research and how to be critical of things. Yeah, I think I really do like science, and I do like taking a really sort of highly specific approach. But I also think what I've learned outside of science in university and all of the academic stuff is more important. So actually basing training around real people and the athlete and their whole life and making it fit around someone's life in a pragmatic way, rather than worrying too much about the details of science. So I think the scientific evidence is sort of the core of everything, but I think it's really important to consider a lot of other factors about people and their lives, their training history and beliefs, that sort of thing.
And do you have quite a wide range of people that you coach now?
Yeah, so I think I mostly coach people who were quite committed climbers. So they're maybe climbing like 7C and above or 8A and above route. But I do work with all sorts of people, different ages, yeah, and different experience levels. Some people I work with, they've like never been rock climbing and they don't have any intention of going rock climbing, but they just want some help with having a little bit of routine in their routine in their climbing and training just as a way to improve their general health.
So it's closer to just like general personal training at that point.
Yeah, in a way, but somewhat related to climbing.
No, I guess it's quite a big thing to, it kind of helps with working with climbers who are already of quite a high ability, I guess, would usually, to be in the place where they are, they probably require a certain amount of motivation, which is intrinsic motivation for climbing anyway. So maybe easier in the sense of it's not such an issue that you prescribe something which nobody ever does, because I feel like that would always be an annoying thing as a coach.
Yeah, I think that's one of the trickiest things though, is, and one of the most important things is actually writing training plans which are possible for people to do and fit in around their real life so they can actually adhere to it, rather than just like creating like a really amazing plan, but something which can't actually be carried out. Because I think people are often very motivated, but maybe there's some other reasons why they can't always get the training done. And I think rather than blame people for not doing it, it's important to see that they're motivated and maybe find issues in the training plan and what I'm describing them if they're not getting it done, and actually work out something which is more feasible and more practical.
Part of your role as well.
Nice. So just briefly then, with the fact that most of your clients are, like, I suppose those grades was just quite, you know, quite high level climbers. Is that, do you like select for those people, or are those just the people that happen to approach you?
I think they just happen to be the people that approach me.
Right. Yeah. Another thing is, I saw you recently put this Instagram post up, which I thought was interesting because I can't wait to talk about it a little bit, where you gave a guy some quite heavy like gym work as part of his training. Yeah. And then he came back to you and said he didn't want to do it, and he had a few reasons why he didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
What is it that makes you so keen on sort of gym work for climbing?
Well, I guess the first thing is the general health benefits. I think that one pushback around climbers have around resistance training is it's not specific. But aside from being specific, I think as athletes, we should aim to just be quite healthy in general, and meeting sort of quite basic exercise recommendations. For example, the exercise recommendations from the World Health Organization suggest that we should be performing resistance training twice a week. So I think that should be quite like a basic thing before we even go on to think about anything more specific. And then from personal experience over the last couple of years with lockdown first and then having a finger injury last year, I've done a lot of resistance training, basic barbell training, and I found it to be really useful. I built up a lot of capacity and I get a lot less pain, and I think I can do a lot more climbing these days.
You don't, if time is a limiting factor for you, and you can get a lot of work done in relatively specific areas as well. It's almost more specific in terms of what it works than generally climbing is, if you're like tactical about what it works on, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's often easy to fit around people's lives because it is so accessible. Like commercial gyms are everywhere. They're often quite cheap these days. People even have gyms at their work or resistance bands at home. So it's quite easy to fit into people's lives.
To say, like, I just got to ask it, because so many climbers will immediately think this when they hear about like heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. How can you do it without gaining too much weight? Or perhaps you should gain the weight and be better for it. What do you say to that?
Yeah, sure. So that's definitely something I hear a lot, and that's a common barrier that people have. And I think people associate strength training with bodybuilders. I think the thing with bodybuilders is they're training in a very specific way. They're often going quite close to failure a lot of the times. So they're fatiguing their muscles that way. And they're doing a lot of volume and training in a way which is very specific and targeted to increasing muscle size. But the main thing is, and the only thing which is really going to make you put on mass, is they're eating in a caloric surplus. So they're eating a lot more calories than they're expending, which makes them put on mass. Whereas with climbing, we're often working at higher intensities and lower volumes. So you're actually improving your strength by learning to use more of the available muscles that you've got and recruiting your muscle fibers through teaching your nervous system rather than building more muscle. And I think if you were to build a little bit more muscle, then there's no problem with that either. And I think it's somewhat inevitable over time if you are increasing your volume.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Because I remember being at a conventional gym and like someone was using these free weights. He was absolutely massive, like this huge tank bodybuilder guy. And I, you know, as climbers, like we quite often feel pretty weedy in weights areas and gyms. So I was feeling a little bit self-conscious as it was, you know, like this is way off, you know, this guy's not down the schoolroom. I wish he was, but like he's there. And I was like, I always remember thinking like, I was going to be so embarrassing because I'm going to have to go and like take all the weights off. And like be doing the same thing, but with like pathetic weights. And then when I actually went and saw what he was doing, I had to put weights on because like he's doing like 100 reps of like 3 kilograms to get to, and it's just a completely different style of training.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's important to realize that those guys are like really trying to look like that as well. Mm. And they're putting a lot of effort into getting big. So if we're not trying to get big, then it's probably not going to happen. And climbers tend to be like really strong with certain exercises, especially with deadlifting. I mean, there's certain things which we're not as good at, but like deadlifting and pulling exercise, I find that climbers are often very good at very quickly.
Mm. Yeah, lat pull downs and things. Climbers are pretty special. You get some weedy climbers maxing out those. Those machines and an absolutely pitiful when it comes to like pushing bench press and
yeah.
So bad at bench press. There's often a idea that doing resistance training is maybe most helpful for injury. I'm not going to say injury prevention, but like reducing chance of injury. Is that something which you feel is maybe one of the more useful parts of it, or the actual direct translation of strength developed as well?
Yeah, I think both of those for sure. So I think one of the reasons why strength training can reduce our risk of injury is not so much actually getting stronger, but more just exposing ourselves to different positions, different loads, and using our muscles in a way which is actually much more intense than we'd ever see on the wall. So when we come to doing it on the wall, we're like totally prepared and almost over strong for it. And it also just gives us more capacity so that we can do more climbing and training, and that has less of an impact on us.
Because you do it as well, don't you, Aiden? You still do
resistance training. Yeah. In fact, I trained my legs today.
Oh, nice.
Leg day.
That doesn't happen very much. I wasn't just like slamming a load of weight and doing squat. I was doing like Cossack squats, what are they called, goblet squats as well, like mostly range of motion. I do actually, I've been doing quite a lot of those Copenhagen planks as well for like adductor stuff. And I found those quite good. I've actually done relatively, I found I use my legs a lot when I climb anyway, and so it makes a lot of sense to do it. But it's actually this was something I thought was interesting to talk about. I don't know if you get, because Buster, you do quite long trips as well. I always find it interesting, and I've been like experimenting with it in the last couple of weeks, where you like, I did like a bunch of training actually before I went on this trip to Switzerland. I've just come back from, I'd had tenosynovitis in the run up to it. So I was actually doing quite a lot of off wall training. I was doing a lot of resistance training and a lot of, I was actually doing quite a lot of on wall stuff, but I'd literally like hang on massive jugs and do like foot walk. And I was focusing a lot on body tension and things. But I did a lot of resistance training, and then I had maybe like a 6 week gap where I didn't do anything of like resistance training really. I was just climbing essentially, like really high intensity, really low volume. It was interesting. I got back from the trip and I was climbing on my board. I was climbing like way better than I ever had. So I was feeling on the wall really good. And then I kind of used that as an opportunity to really see what applied well to the style in which I was climbing on rock. I was going back and measuring the exercise, comparing like my results from the exercise that I was doing in resistance training to see what applies quite well to the way in which I normally climb.
Yeah, so did you sort of do some testing and you had an idea of the numbers before you went away on the trip and then you looked at things when you got back?
Yeah. I didn't have a testing day beforehand and afterwards. I just was like looking at the numbers that I'd had done. It would have been good to be more organized and have like a specific testing day. But it was more kind of just comparing roughly trend.
Yeah, I think one, did you felt like you lost much in other exercises? What did you sort of find elsewhere?
Well, actually...
Give us the results.
My pull-ups have gone down a bit. Well, actually, they were pretty similar anyway. My bench press had gone down a load. External rotations had gone up massively, which I'm a bit confused about. Yeah. But like four and a half, they increased like four kilos. I would do like 10 reps whenever I test it. And it went up loads. I think like shoulder press, I was worse at as well. There were things which definitely did go down. There was like a few things which did noticeably increase. Fingers, obviously, it's very finger intensive as a place. And I think I personally benefit from high intensity, low volume.
But how were you testing your fingers? Were you doing it like on a fingerboard? Yeah.
On a fingerboard, yeah.
And
yeah.
So your fingerboarding weight actually went up after just climbing?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. I wouldn't expect that. I always thought fingerboarding would just be too specific to fingerboarding to ever go up just by climbing.
I was kind of on crimps for about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on what measure you're using to test, because strength can sort of be applied in a lot of different ways. And one thing I definitely see is that in myself and also in my clients is that people lose that really slow and heavy strength to sort of apply a lot of load on a bigger edge and also contact strength to apply that load quickly, but they make gains in finger strength in terms of like more weird holds and using smaller holds. I think that's what happens when you go outside. You learn to apply that strength in a variety of different contexts, whereas indoors we're maybe applying our strength in a very specific and sort of crude way just on like a nice big edge. Whereas outside, we see like much smaller edges and weirder holds and different types of grips. And I see that those often go up. We get more. I definitely feel that in my own climbing, especially climbing a bit in the Franken Euro, where all of the holds are sort of all over the place. I feel really strong when I first get out there on the board. But then when I get on the rock, it's like, oh, I can't use any of these holds. And then it takes a while to get used to teach my nervous system how to apply that strength in less ideal situations and more complex holds. So maybe that improves, but the actual force production in a really ideal situation might drop down a little bit.
Yeah, when you climb outside, the holds were never made to be climbed on, were they? Like, you know, getting used to climbing with fingers in very weird positions. And the Duo looks to epitomize that the most extreme.
Yeah, definitely. I went to have a look at some of the bouldering there. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of hard bouldering and it all looks totally desperate.
Yeah, it's meant to be. I've actually heard the bouldering's not that pockety, right? It's like really crimpy.
Yeah, the route climbing is pretty crimpy as well. I think Action Direct just gives people this certain idea. I mean, there is a lot of pockets there, but there's an equal amount of crimps.
Yeah, okay. Maybe it's just from the UK where there's very few pockets.
But the boulders there are notoriously sandbagged, aren't they?
They all look desperate. I didn't try any of them, but they like it was kind of like that the peak lime kind of vibe, like really dirty, weird, polished holds and quite ugly bits of rock. But if you like mean crimps and like hard climbing, I think it would be a good place to visit.
Tempted, Aiden?
Yeah, it's all a bit, it's undocumented, isn't it? They're a bit careful with access, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of the climbing there is on private land.
Be sensitive.
Oh, right, yeah, that's never good. But before we go too far, diversion to rock, which will come later. One of the things I had down that I wanted to ask you, because I always like asking anyone who coaches anything, actually, not even just climbing, but anyone who coaches climbers, what are the classic pitfalls that your new clients have? So not ones that you've had for a while, but like, you know, people you're just getting to know, what are the common mistakes that people make in their training?
Oh, it's hard to, I don't know. I wouldn't want to criticize anyone's approach because I think people have different perspectives and different beliefs, which might have come from like an individual experience. And they might be doing something which is different to how I would do things, but they might have a different rationale for that.
Mm.
But I think what I see in the wider sort of training space as a whole is people getting a bit too obsessed with the really small details and sort of maybe disregarding some of the basic principles of training. So people are looking for quick fixes and they want to hear the secret when really there isn't a secret. I think it's one of the main things is just following the basic principles of training. So making sure the training is specific to your goals, it's specific to you as an individual, and you're following the principle of progressive overload, eating well, sleeping well, managing stress, that sort of thing. I think and being consistent is far more important than worrying about whether you're hanging for 3 seconds or 5 seconds. It's almost like people analyze these things so much that it actually stops you from doing the training. You want so much to find what's optimal that if you're not doing what's optimal, you almost don't stick to it in the same way.
Yeah. So you think maybe people sometimes worry too much if they're having like a hangboard session where they're less good than last time.
Yeah.
It's like, that's okay. Just the point is just getting the session done.
Yeah. Yeah,
rather than worrying overly too much about it. Interesting. Do you agree with something that I've said a couple of times, I think already on the podcast, that I think quite a lot of climbers overtrain? Do you see that or do you not really see that?
In what context?
As in, like, I see a lot of climbers having sort of a lot of 6 days on and double session days, yeah, and things, and training kind of like kind of similar things. And I guess like, we don't know. So like, my theory is that it's too much, but like, we don't know because we you know, there's no like proper science that's going into it. But like, you don't really see a lot of correlation to other sports. Like no other sport will train like a really similar muscle group twice a day for 6 days a week.
Yeah. And also there's like no obvious difference. Like there's also climbers that maybe climb like 3 or 4 days a week. And it's not like they're behind the pack of those who climb 6 days a week kind of thing.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think for some people, it depends what you're training. So I think if you're training your capacity and you're training to climb more, then maybe more volume is important. But I think for strength training, then quality becomes much more important. So for bouldering, for instance, I think having quality sessions is more important than getting volume in. But at a certain level, I think there is a time when you do have to start to increase your volume, but certainly training twice a day, 6 days a week isn't always appropriate.
Yeah.
Applies well to the combine format these days in comps.
Yeah.
You are 6 days on a, yeah.
Yeah, I think if you're only having one rest day, it means you're only having one session after rest day. You're only having one session a week where you're like fully recovered and putting in really quality efforts. And I like to see people having like those quality board sessions, quality fingerboard sessions more often than just once a week. Because like on the sixth day, it's not going to be a high quality session.
Yeah, you essentially sub max for most
of
your time.
How about you guys? How often do you tend to climb, or does it sort of vary?
I tend to do 2 days on, one day off. I like tend to, and I've done that for so long, really. I mean, so every now and then I've dropped down to one day on, one day off because it just life stuff, really. But
yeah,
but like 2 days on, one day off always works really nicely for me. I feel good, and like, and then I enjoy my rest day. And on my rest day, I don't really want to go climbing because I feel tired enough. So
yeah,
it's like a good balance for me. But yeah, I've never really tried to change it, so maybe. Maybe that's a problem too.
Probably follow about the same thing. I think in the past I have done, like, I think I probably like maybe I climb 5 days a week or something, like as in like some, I'd on a rare occasion do 3 days on, but very rarely. I'm probably, yeah, two is probably usually my max. I do quite like having rest day, having one day on, having a rest day. I feel I benefit quite a lot from low volume. I often feel like long trips don't make me climb worse. Like I often end up feeling pretty good. If depending what I'm on, if I'm on something physical, that kind of high intensity, a lot of rest seems to work quite well for me.
I'm pretty sure I read your mate Dan Varian saying, if you want to climb hard, you got to rest hard. I'm pretty sure that's the Dan Varian quote.
So yeah, he rests hard. Yeah. yeah, he's a full-time dad, so he's got a good excuse.
But so
if I did that, I'd just be lazy.
But I also, you know, we're having this conversation, but I've seen you, Buster, on a rock trip, and I don't remember a lot of resting going on.
No, I think my approach has definitely changed. I don't think I had any sense of tactics back then. That's something I've been working on, especially this year. I'm mostly climb day on, day off, or 2 days on, but mostly one on, one off.
And is that even with the training back home, or more in when you're on the rock trip?
I think it depends. I think it depends what I'm training, but I think for like the quality sort of strength and power phase, I think climbing less is often seems to work better. But I think that can be really hard for people, and I think people are really psyched and they want to do something. They want to feel like they're improving their climbing, and that's a challenge I find when writing training plans, is finding something for those people to do. Because if they are motivated and they do have energy to use, and that's when people less specific exercises to do, like maybe go for a run or do a core circuit, things which won't maybe help their climbing as much, but it just means you can feel like you're doing something to improve, and actually being well rested enough to train your fingers again the next day.
Mm-hmm. You give them something to keep them busy, basically, in between, so they're well rested.
Yeah.
His fingers, yeah, they are a small, like, they're a small network of muscles, aren't they? To slam that 6 days,
yeah,
multiple sessions on some of those days feels a bit crazy.
But it's also tendon remodeling, isn't it, rather than muscle training with fingers. That's the problem. That's why we got so, like, you know, the research is so nascent in climbing, because like all other sports are doing muscle training, essentially. Well, muscle training and technique is basically all other sports, whereas we're doing tendon remodeling as well, and that's much rarer to come across in other sports.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. Yeah, we're definitely stressing our fingers and pulleys in a very unique way. I think one of the only other places I've read about pulley injuries in athletes is in like baseball players sometimes.
Yes, baseball pitchers.
Yeah,
that's like one of my favorite little random facts to throw out, is that like sports physios who the only other sports physios who've dealt with a lot of pulley injuries are people who deal with baseball pitchers, because they throw with so much force and they whip the ball with their fingers so hard that they can actually do their pulleys when they do that, which is incredible. Which has always made me wonder, can we find a elite level baseball pitcher to come climbing and see how good it would be?
I mean, it's very very different. Like we're generally quite isometric when we climb, aren't we? Like a bit of a different thing.
Well, also, actually, it's quite often hand, isn't it? So
we're good at dead angles on one hand. It's often actually when people like drop into things where like we get some it's a common dropping from like a crimp or whatever into a drag is often quite a when we get movement, it's usually a bad sign for us.
The good thing about the baseball pitchers again there is we'd be able to use science with just one, because they have one hand that they haven't trained and one that they have.
Perfect.
So we can train, like test it. How good is baseball pitching for climbing?
N of one is actually N of two.
Or perhaps I'm thinking about it the wrong way. Perhaps I should be more thinking which of us climbers should get into pitching baseballs.
But I kind of touched on it earlier. This is something I thought And I was wondering whether you, it's possible that the measurement of climbing ability via just testing your physicalities is quite reductive. What makes a good climber?
Yeah, it's a funny one that, but people are really into the numbers and metrics. I'm kind of guilty of that myself. I do a lot of my fingerboarding with the Tyndak, like a little force.
Oh yeah, that thing looks good.
Force plate. And I actually lost it a few weeks ago. And then I didn't want to do my fingerboarding. I lost all motivation. I was like, oh, there's no numbers. I can't try and beat myself. So for some people, it's a useful motivator, but I think it's important not to attach too much to those numbers and be so flexible about adjusting up and down when needed. Because like you say, there's so much more to climbing than how much force you can put through your fingers on a 20-mil edge.
It's definitely kind of quite party trick. I definitely used to find that as well. Oh, I don't feel very strong. I mean, I guess I have to do more one-armers or something, but
yeah.
I felt like I was missing a trick somewhat. I felt easy to get sucked down that and feel like that was what you needed to do without maybe the necessary reflection on how you climb and what you actually want to do with it. Because I think it took me a little while to realize, but I realized that I don't actually mind that much whether I can do a one-armer holding a weight or something. I want to get up a bit of rock, basically. It's equally as arbitrary, but for me, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, it's important to keep the actual goal in mind, isn't it?
Yeah. Easy to get sucked into training. I definitely find.
I think the main assessment process for the climbers that I work with is probably conversation and watching videos and just chatting about their climbing experience, what they want to do, where they feel they're at. I find that's far more valuable than looking at numbers.
That's interesting.
Yeah, good to know.
Even the sort of basic tests of finger strength on a 20-mil edge, that only gives us one measurement of strength applied in that specific context, whereas I think we use our finger strength in many different ways. Like I mentioned earlier, in the Frankenmuir, you've got split pockets. In other places, you've got slopers. Sometimes you're applying a lot of force very quickly. Other times you're cranking down on a hold more slowly. So I think I'm personally someone who's, one of my strengths is producing a lot of force on a big edge, whereas I can only just hang the 8 mil crimps at body weight. So I think even though I can produce a lot of force on a big edge, maybe I can't produce as much force on a small edge. So you could say I've got strong fingers in a certain context, but in another context, I don't have strong fingers. So one thing I quite like to do is design an individual testing protocol for different people, depending on their goals and what they want to work on. Mm-hmm. So it's not like one basic test. I mean, there are basic tests that I use for everyone, but I also like to create more specific testing protocols for something a bit like what you said earlier, Aidan, like you test something, you go away and climb, and then you come back and test again and see if you've progressed.
No, it sounds way more logical than just like measuring everything on a set edge to that kind of feels like the protocol you want, right? Like for me personally, training is the means to an end kind of thing, so it makes sense to start with the end. Whether it's training or not.
It's been cool to see you do to read and watch videos of your replica training, because I think it was almost like specific training became uncool for a while. Like it almost took something. I almost felt like people thought that it took something away from your achievement if you had to train specifically. But in my eyes, you're almost not training if you're not training specifically. Like what's the point? It's just random exercise.
It is so helpful. I built up most of my training for comps where it does like really benefit to be a generalist, but if you've got specific things to do, it just makes so much sense. But I know that thing. I mean, like I think I got some kick. Sam sent me some posts somebody did saying that setting a replica took away from the magic of climbing or something. I guess it's very subjective.
I found this funny Instagram page which basically was calling Aidan out for that very thing, saying that to make a replica, as you say, Buster, just diminishes the achievement when you do it, which I thought was so funny. Because it's like all training is, in a sense, like a bad replica. Like, you know, if you're trying to get strong on a board, you're essentially doing a really bad replica of something that's a similar kind of angle. So it's just making it more specific.
Yeah.
I just found it such a funny line to draw.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Yeah, it's like, it's almost cooler to like just train poorly and then just turn up and like get up the climb out of pure luck whilst you've been training for something totally different.
Just reminds me of my like GCSE days where like all my friends were telling me, yeah, I'm not revising, mate. And, I was like, oh, sweet, me neither. Forget this. And then I remember on results day, they all had like amazing results. And they were like, oh yeah, we were actually revising. I was like, well, someone could have told me.
Yeah, no.
I think it kind of depends where you're at with your climbing as well. So I don't think maybe getting super specific would be as appropriate for someone who's new for climbing. Whereas maybe actually having a more broader base might help them achieve their goal. So at the moment I'm training for first round, first minute in Spain, and actually the training I'm doing doesn't look that similar to what you find on first round, but I think it works my weaknesses in ways which might help me get better at my strength in a way.
So that's like very analytical about like your limitations.
The climbing on first round is very much my style. It's very power endurance, very physical, but at some point you get to a rest and you've really got to relax in that rest, because it's not a very good rest, because you've still got like an 8A plus boulder problem to do after that. So what the training I'm doing at the moment, or the rock climbing I'm doing at the moment, is based around learning to relax more on the rock and doing longer climbs, which involve more knee bar rests and positions, getting into stressful positions and then trying to calm down a little bit. So I don't think at this point I need to be too specific. And also, I'm not very good at setting replicas. So I think if you're not good at setting replicas, I think it's better to do, maybe make a few replicas, so you don't really good at one replica, which is nothing like the very good training block.
Yeah. You just get really confused when you turn up and you're, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
If it should be there.
I agree completely. If in doubt, set one and train on that for a couple of weeks, then try again. You know, like keep trying. Yeah, I think that's totally accurate. But I thought, why did I think you'd already done first round, first minute? Have you done something else very similar?
I did a route called First Lay, which shares
the
first three quarters, and then it finishes up a 7C route, whereas first round's got like another hard boulder problem, this like really iconic one I move on.
Because I remember watching you on First Lay one, and what I always remember is just you were climbing so quickly. Like insanely fast.
Yeah.
And it's like, was that like a deliberate thing to just keep going before you got tired? Or was it just you learnt it so well, you might as well go quickly?
Yeah, I think a combination of both. And I think sadly, I've lost, as I've got stronger, I think I've lost a little bit of that in my climbing. So I think I like done a lot of training with weights and maybe not spent enough time climbing on rock due to injuries and that kind of thing. And I think I've lost a little bit of that. And actually going back on the route, now I'm much stronger, but I don't feel like I move as well on it. But I'm sure with time, I hope that will come back and I'll be able to climb like that again. But I think I maybe need to find a little bit more of a balance between climbing like that, because I think it's very easy to make mistakes. I think with route climbing, you want to try and climb as fast and as quick as you can, but without compromising any efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when you have the strength to slow things down, it's hard not to use it and be less efficient for it.
It's almost like an arrogance sometimes. It's weird. Like when I was trying action, I was like doing these French blows and like locking down moves. And it was like proving to myself that I was strong to try and like make me feel confident and make me feel like I was going to do it in a way.
It's like the idea, I'm not only going to do this climb, but I'm going to make it look easy.
But it's like totally counterproductive. It's just going to make
more exciting. That becomes way more of like a problem in routes where efficiency is king, right? Yeah. I haven't really dipped into that game. I'm quite keen to try it out sometime.
Aiden declared himself a route climber the other day.
I wouldn't say that. I haven't tied in yet. No, I'm keen to give it a go, basically. I'm planning on going. I've got a long trip in Europe in spring, and I think I might try and finish it with some sport climb.
Oh, nice. That'd be cool. Mm-hmm. Could you use yourself in with some sort of bouldery power endurance sport routes?
Well, I can't really tell. Maybe I'll do that, or maybe I'll just do some like really long fitnessy ones and just like plod and have it as a holiday and do some moving and learn how to actually move efficiently. Because I generally, even for a boulder, I generally like end up like I tense up quite a lot. I'm quite rigid quite a lot of the time when I climb. So I think that won't cross over so well with route. Now I'm kind of keen to
That'd be awesome.
try something new.
Kind of what I've been trying to teach myself as well at the moment is just to hold on as lightly as possible and just relax. I think when you climb on the board a lot where it's all about pulling as hard as you can, you get on like a long route or on a sport route and it's the opposite. You need to preserve as much energy as possible, not expend as much of it as you can in a short space of time.
Easily. Over gripping is not a problem when you're on a four move problem on a school board. You absolutely want to over grip.
You very briefly mentioned about not having climbed so much because of injuries, but I did want to talk about one injury in particular that you had, because you did a pulley, didn't you, Buster?
Yeah, I ruptured day four pulley on my ring finger last June.
And I remember you ruptured it, and yet you did a really active like rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up, I think you were back climbing on the wall, presumably on, you know, bigger holds, but after about 4 weeks or something, it was very quick.
Yeah, I think I started loading on the fingerboard after about 10 days.
Whoa.
And then back into climbing after about 4 weeks. And then within 8 weeks, I was climbing like 8A on the school board. And then I think another month later, I'd repeated like 8B, I repeated Keen Roof at the top. So I did start loading it quite early. I think that's often quite an old school approach used for pulley rehab these days, with lots of rest and being very conservative, splinting the finger. But I think the issue with that is as soon as we stop climbing and stop loading our fingers, we're actually maybe increasing our risk of re-injury, because we reduce the capacity of the other tissues in our fingers as well as the injured tissue. Whereas I think what we want to be doing is starting to, after the initial sort of inflammatory phase, is starting to stress our connective tissue and stress our, and start to desensitize to pain so we can get back to climbing sooner.
Mm. So what, when you say like after 10 days you started loading on the fingerboard, can you talk us through a little bit about the process and what you did? Obviously with the caveat that everyone listening, this is not a recommendation for what you should do with the same injury. This is just talking about what Buster did.
So the first thing I started doing was hanging with a three finger drag on a really rounded pull-up bar. And the main reason I used a pull-up bar is because it actually stops, because when you crimp, that's the bowstringing where your tendon comes away from the bone. And actually by hanging on a pull-up bar, you're stopping any bowstring from happening because the pull-up bar is in the way. So I just started doing some long hangs with three fingers. And I chose three fingers rather than four, because I found with four fingers it was a bit more of a crimp and it stressed the pulley a little bit more. So actually three fingers, even without the pinky, it felt a little bit less stressful. Yeah, and I just started hanging. And as my pain decreased, I increased the load. And to begin with, that was by reducing the edge size. And then, so from the pull-up bar, I went on to the big slots on the Beastmaker 2000. And I just slowly reduced the edge size over time.
I remember, I think it was maybe before that time. Maybe it was before you actually did that injury. But I remember seeing a video you put out about it was a little comparison of rehab and training. Mm-hmm. And like it was like a little two videos side by side. And it was funny because the videos were the same, but yeah. I have a really clear memory of it, of and like kind of emphasizing on the kind of the same protocol of progressive overload, right? I think you said that was one of the fundamentals of training earlier, because in that is a really classic thing when people rehabbing things is you can almost be too sensitive to the pain, right? As in like obviously pain's a guide, but it's not necessarily. Well, I don't know if that's actually, maybe that's a different stage of your injury. But people can be almost too tentative with it. I know I've definitely had it in the past of being not really accepting any discomfort at all, anything which even if it was like feeling a bit weird, doing absolutely nothing. And it didn't really feel like it made it any better. Yeah, I don't know. I remember finding that analogy of training as a form of rehab was quite interesting. But this sounds like what you're doing really, kind of.
Yeah, pretty much. I guess the main difference is just the entry point's different, and I think that's what you're looking for when you start to rehab, is find something that you can tolerate and then slowly progress from there and build up, like you said, using the principle of progressive overload. And for sure, there's a lot more going on with our experience of pain rather than just what's going on with the actual tissue. For example, maybe things we hear from coaches or friends about what they think is going on with their injuries. Or one thing I found quite hard was I was getting a lot of suggestions of what I should be doing and shouldn't be doing. And that can make you feel quite anxious. And I think that anxiety can maybe make the feeling of pain worse, and as well as sort of increasing the capacity of the tissue whilst you're rehabbing. That's another thing you're doing. You're slowly starting to build back your confidence in yourself and desensitize to the pain.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, because it's really big, and there is that whole like, is it psychosomatic injury where somatic. Like people somatic, yeah, I can't remember where you kind of like almost just expect pain, and then even when there's actually minimal tissue damage, you can still feel pain.
That's how you can kind of develop chronic pain for stuff where there's no lasting tissue damage. And I think what you were trying to say earlier, Aidan, which is totally correct, is that there is no correlation between, well, there's no accurate correlation between pain and tissue damage. Like, yeah. You know, it's like if you rupture your pulley, you're not going to have any pain, but it's fully ruptured. You know, like Molly was saying, when she did all three pulleys and it wasn't even painful. Like sometimes you don't get the pain when you've got a lot of damage, and sometimes you get a lot of pain when you've not got a lot of damage. So it's not totally accurate.
Yeah. For example, I think I've read a paper where they scanned the fingers of climbers, and they actually found that some people had what would indicate a level of bowstring that would indicate a full pulley rupture, that they'd never experienced any pain. And then others with the opposite, where they had pain, but there wasn't anything going on in the tissue and they couldn't see any sort of rupture. I think with more traumatic and acute injuries, there is a bit more of a correlation. I think when it gets into chronic injuries, like you spoke about with Huffy recently, that's when things get a little bit more different and the psychology becomes more important.
Yeah, you can train your brain to feel pain for a stimulus. So even if, and that's what our brain accidentally does anyway, if we're so used to feeling pain doing an exercise, then you can actually train your brain to feel the pain even after the injury is recovered. It's like this really complicated way that chronic injuries come about. Not always, it's just a way, but because obviously a lot of the time with chronic injuries you have got a problem, but
yeah.
But it's funny. But yeah, I thought that was really cool, because I remember just always thinking that like if to do a pulley rupture, to go for the kind of full early loading protocol would probably be the fastest way back. But it's just that fear of like, oh God, I might be overdoing this. And then, you know, 6 weeks in, you re-rupture or something. And it's like that thing that would hold you back.
Yeah, for sure. And I definitely had an element of that where I didn't really do anything for a while. But I think we know from sort of ligaments in other areas of the body, I mean, we can't really apply it directly to pulleys, but maybe we can take inspiration from some of the research and the ways that people are managing ankle sprains and ACL injuries, where early loading seems like the way to go.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk now in training is a lot more talk now about form than there used to be a few years back, particularly to do with like fingerboard form. Is that something that you're worried about? Do you worry about the exact form in the way your clients are fingerboarding or yourself, or do you not worry too much?
Yeah, I try not to worry too much and try not to make other people, my clients, worry about it too much either, because that's one of those psychological or social things which could negatively influence somebody and maybe make a problem where there isn't one.
Mm.
It's kind of like the opposite of a placebo. I think people's bodies are very different and people move in different ways. So it's really hard to say what is good form and what is bad form. I don't think there are any positions which are more dangerous than any others. I think what's more important is to make sure that we are training appropriately and progressing at an appropriate level. I think managing our load is more important than worrying about the certain positions that we're in.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me, because like when you're training at home, you know, even if it's not perfect form, it's probably better than your fingers will be the moment you touch real holds and your fingers are splayed all over the place. Like,
yeah, it's better to be prepared for it.
But like, it's just a general like discussion point, really, more than a question. But when I was at the schoolroom the other day, I was with Billy and Hannah Slaney. And just as we were climbing on the board, it was just funny noticing how like everyone holds the holds so differently. Hannah was like, the way she was crimping, her hand was fully turned out and it was like really, her wrists were kind of active. And I was wondering, and we were all wondering, it's like, is it worth trying to combat that at this stage when you're someone who's climbed that way for a really long time and you've got to a really high level? Or do you just think that's the way I hold holds and just try and get, you know, keep just trying to get stronger at it?
Yeah, it's hard to know if it would have any benefit to change it or if that is what best suits it, or maybe, like you say, maybe it's something that isn't useful. I don't know if we've got a way of knowing it yet.
You kind of need to figure out what you wanted to do as well, isn't it? It feels like if you've got something that's working well for the thing that you're trying to do, like you kind of got to understand where you're trying to get to.
So maybe for myself, actually, I tend to hold most holds in more of an open-handed grip position, but I'm quickly realizing, especially with bouldering, that I really need to learn how to crimp. So maybe that would be a situation where I could force or train with a particular finger position and try and get better at it. So I'm pretty useless with full crimping. It's not something I've ever done. So what I've been doing recently is firstly training on the fingerboard, but also getting on the wall and climbing with really big footholds and just practicing that grip position to build up the confidence as well as the finger strength.
Because there's a lot of complexity about pronation and supination around the wrist as well. When you start playing with different grip positions, it all connects in quite awkward ways, isn't it?
I find with pinching, like, there's so many different wrist positions, and that gets like really, really funny, really interesting. They let you pick up a pinch block sometimes and it feels really easy. And then 5 minutes later, you go to pick it up again and you can't, but it's just like a subtle change in the way you're positioning your wrist or placing your fingers on it.
I did in lockdown, did quite a lot of pinch block training and found it didn't really apply to pinches at all, because I found the limiting factor for me was so much more regularly my wrist. It felt like it was so much more applicable just to be climbing on pinches, because it like mimicked that like movement around them as well. Keeping things climbing specific.
Sure.
When you said that to me in the very, I think it was the very first podcast we did, you said that, Aidan, about pinch blocks not really working out because your wrists are too, your wrists are in one position. And that has always, I really believed that. And ever since, I've really thought every time you're doing a pinch, how much work your wrist is doing. Like you don't really squeeze that much on a pinch, do you? There's like a bit of passive squeeze, but really the bit that feels like it's working is more the wrist for me. So I really believe that. I've cast out any thought of doing pinch block training, and I've drunk the Kool-Aid.
Just climb on pinches.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You're saying you climb mostly on open-handed when you've climbed, Buster. Maybe partly because you've been doing some training for Action Direct and that video just came out. The stuff that I see you do these days, it seems like you excel in the open-handed monos and split fingers and pockets. Is that something which like was Did the open-handed strength of yours climbing open-handed translate quite easily to that? Or did you have to be quite careful and methodical to build that up quite carefully?
I think in recent years, I've climbed a lot on the board at the school and on just boards in general. There tends to be quite a lot of half grip. So that was my strongest grip. And I think I did like a lattice test and I was told that I had like no finger strength. So I really focused on the half grip for a while. And then that kind of became my strength, but it was actually when I ruptured my pulley, when I started training the open hand more. And I think
I wondered if that played a role.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what led to me getting a little bit stronger on those types of grips. But there was definitely a period where I was quite strong on the three finger drag, but I didn't quite have the confidence, or I hadn't learned to apply that strength on the monos in the same way. But what I did to build up that confidence, to build up the strength, was I started with quite long hands where I had quite a big buffer to failure, and then I would reduce that sort of buffer and get closer to failure for a hang at a certain length, and then I would reduce the length of the hang, increase the intensity again with a big buffer, and then reduce that buffer, get closer to failure, and then I did that all the way down until I was doing like 5 second max hangs on monos. But I found actually none of that helped.
Wow, okay. Okay. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, that was a curveball.
No, I think it was important for building that capacity and building that initial confidence. But what really helped was doing some bouldering on monos on the board and actually like putting my fingers in some sharper monos. And I think what made the biggest difference was actually doing these sort of like mono holds on the wall, where I'd put my finger in a mono, a really sharp mono, and then just do sort of dead hangs with my feet on the wall. Then I started moving between monos, and then I slowly progressed that, started doing circuits on monos until I was doing like full-on limit bouldering with like dinos between monos. But it's kind of hard because in the UK there are no pockets.
Yeah. Yeah, basically none.
Not really, no. Yeah. Let's talk a bit about Action Direct, because it's come up a couple of times. Has that been something that's like always been on your life list?
Yeah, definitely. It's not something that I thought I'd be climbing anytime soon. I think it's a big thing was the pulley injury, and then spending a lot of time in Margalef earlier this year, and over the years I started to feel a bit more confident on monos. I was like, maybe I should try it. But a year ago, I didn't think I would be doing it anytime soon. Like back then, I could barely take my feet off the ground with two fingers on monos.
Yeah. And when did you first go take a look at it?
In June or July. I actually went out there. I planned to do like a long trip and get it done, but it was like way too hot, so I ended up going bouldering in Magic Wood and in Silvretta, and I just did a couple of days on it in July.
Yeah, it's not really a summer venue, is it? So.
I think it can be okay in the summer because it's in the forest.
Oh, okay.
Particularly hot year there.
Yeah, it was a warm summer.
How many days did it take you?
5 days.
Oh, it's just 5 days. That's not that bad in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of funny. I didn't really make much progress from the first day to the fifth day. It was kind of like this one move, this one hill hood was really shutting me down the whole time.
Ah, so it was a heel, not a hand, after all that mono training.
Yeah.
Yeah, you associate it with the jump off the mono, don't you? Like, it's got, yeah, you kind of think it's got to be the hard bit, but...
I never actually fell off that move. I kind of, my second go on the route, tried from the ground, and I did that move first go, got up to this hill hook, and then proceeded to fall off that same move for 5 days until I did it.
I imagine there must have been a bit of throwing your shoes around at some points then.
No, I managed to stay, like, because it was Action Direct and it was something, yeah, I dreamt of, and like, it stayed like a very nice experience until actually the day I did it. Marsha had actually made a little film about it, and she'd come out to film, and I had a cut on my finger, and like some of the holds were wet, and I didn't really want to be there. And that day I was a little bit frustrated, but the rest of it was like, was really happy. And I was very patient. I didn't care how long it took. I wanted to get it done kind of thing.
Wait, but that day you're talking about was the one you did it?
Yeah.
I was a bit droppy, but I went and like had one of those walks, gave myself like, just chilled, forgot about it for a bit and came back and got up it.
Yeah. That's nice.
People often say that getting angry is a really good thing to do sometimes in climbing, because like that kind of rage send that people talk about, it's never worked for me personally. Yeah. But so for you, you felt it was better to just do the opposite and calm right down.
Yeah, definitely. It was one of those days where I like, it rarely happens, but I didn't want to be at the crag that day. Like my skin was really sore. I'd cut one of my fingers on that starting mono. And so I couldn't really use it. And every go I was having, it was like really hurting. It just didn't feel nice to be on the wall. But in the end, I just started using my ring finger and that helped.
And is that the same ring finger that you injured?
No, it was
okay,
on the other hand, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be a bit of trauma, hey? Though, I think we spoke about it, Fuffy. Can be stronger once they're properly rehabbed, can't they?
Yeah, Huffy said very rare to get a re-rupture to rehab to pulley. Once it's done it once, it's unlikely to do it again, which is very nice. That's a nice thing to hear, isn't it?
Yeah. You can only have, 20 devastating finger injuries on each hand. you'd be doing well to up your rave. We also actually, one of our Patreons asked this, but I was thinking about it, was, wait, is it only you and Alex that have done both Hubble and Action Direct?
Yeah,
I think it is. Yeah. And they asked, which did you find harder? Which,
I mean, it's a classic.
You don't have to answer it.
It's a classic.
I think it makes me kind of sad every time I hear that question. It kind of like takes away a little bit of the ascent, because I wasn't thinking about the grades at all. Like maybe if I hadn't have climbed any other 9A's, then the grade would be important. But man, I was just climbing. I wanted to climb Action Direct because it was Action Direct and Hubble for the same reasons, because of the history. And I've been inspired by Ben, knowing him personally, reading a lot about his training and his career over the years, and the same with Wolfgang. I think that was what inspired me to climb them rather than the number. But I think what people really want to know is which is the first 9A in the world. And the comparison between the two seems a bit of a shame, but I can see why people want to know which one, if Hubble is 9A or... and what the deal with that is.
They're such radically different routes as well, right? Like, Hubble is kind of a very strange route.
Yeah,
I guess, like, they're both quite short.
I feel like to honour our patroons, I have to can, is that something we can press you to an answer?
Yeah, I'll answer the question.
Yeah.
I haven't really answered this question, but, and I don't want people to take this out of context, but I definitely found Action easier, but I climbed Hubble 2 years ago and I climbed one 9A then, and I hadn't climbed any 8C pluses. And then now I've climbed maybe 8C pluses, some other 9As. So I've improved as a climber, and I think Action Direct was more my style. But that's absolutely not me saying that I think that Action's an easier route.
Yeah.
And I think I wouldn't really be able to say if either of them was harder than the other, because Hubble's much more, it's much shorter, it's more dependent on body positions, whereas Action Direct is more based around power endurance, and it's a lot more basic, it's a lot more simple. But I think that Hubble's 9A, if Action is, then Hubble certainly is.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think that's as good an answer as you could possibly give.
yeah, that was good.
Particularly with historical problems and routes, it's like you kind of want them, because there's so much more than the grade. Like if Action Direct was like 8C plus, you still would have been just as psyched to do it, you know, like because it's because of the history. It's kind of irrelevant of the grade. It's more modern things that, even those, we don't like talking too much about the grades, do we, Aidan?
The thing that I don't get is why I feel like it's generally been very well accepted that, like, beyond like any like obvious honest mistake, missing something obvious about the intricacies of a climb, why the grade or always be subjected to future ascensionist opinion, and why like it's almost expected that they will always have to present some opinion. Kind of not the nicest part of the process of developing something to decide what it is. And I think part of that is because these days when you do it, everyone expects future ascensionists to downgrade it or make some comment on it. I don't know.
It used to kind of feel like you sort of get what you're given. Like if it says this in the guidebook, that's what you take it as. But now, like, I think on social media and on websites where people are logging their climbs, it's easier for people to give their comment, and that's expected of you.
Yeah.
But there's also this weird pressure to downgrade. We joked about it already, but like I saw loads of comments on the thing that Aidan and Will just did recently in Switzerland. But like there are people in the comments downgrading it on their behalf because from the sofa, if you've both done it, it's a downgrade then. And like people in the comments are almost looking quite annoyed that it's not getting downgraded. It's funny. Why do people care? I don't know.
And I think the only people who can actually give a sort of valid assessment of how hard something is the people that have actually climbed it from bottom to top.
Mm.
So I think me having climbed both Action and Hubble doesn't give me any better perspective than somebody who's just climbed one of them.
Mm. But it still must feel good to be able to say you've climbed both Action Direct and Hubble, because that's pretty cool.
Yeah, both of them were like childhood dreams of mine. So it's cool to get them done.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other, history-wise, there are no greater ticks than those two in route climbing. Or is there?
There's definitely some... It'd be cool to do biography as well. And first round, yeah. I think in my eyes, those two have a similar
so that's
sort of
kind
aura
of
around them.
The next era
the more
of
modern ones.
Yeah.
I'd almost thought, maybe his biography a bit surpassing Power Endurance, but it's like very like free-fingery.
Yeah, it's pockets, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, have you ever tried it?
No, I've not tried it. Every time I've been to Sayuse in the last few years, I've been like sort of out of shape, or I've been drinking loads of beer and not really training properly. So it'd be cool to go back there in good shape and give it a go.
I feel like that used to be like the cool way to climb in as well, wasn't it? We were talking earlier about training. Well, wasn't cool to be able to not only train and drink a load of beer and then rock up and just climb really hard. Yeah. That was like the dream, I guess.
Yeah. How about you guys? Have either of you been on Hubble? I'm sure you'd both get on pretty well with it.
I've never tied in outside.
Oh, really?
No, yeah.
Have you not?
No.
Wow. Yeah, no, I'm quite keen to get on Hubble. I was going to get on it with Molly, but a bit of a spanner in the works with a slightly injured leg.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'm quite keen to get on it. Yeah.
If there was something that was going to make me want to tie in for it, would be Hubble, because also for the two reasons of the fact that it's kind of a glorified boulder problem anyway. I mean, it's got this really hard boulder and then supposedly a much easier finish. Whether I would find it much easier is another question, but for route climbers at least.
It's certainly bouldery.
Yeah, I think it's interesting though. Even those bouldery routes, it feels very different. It's not bouldering.
Yeah.
It's not bouldering. It requires a different headspace and a different approach, I think.
Yeah. Maybe not the finest of intro routes to tying in. Might want to learn to clip some quick draws first.
As a lot of people told me on the internet, I mean, I top roped most of Hubble, so it doesn't count. You don't really clip anything on any of the hard climbing until it's over.
But that makes sense, right? Where can you clip?
Yeah.
Nobody clips, do they?
No. I think everyone's done it with the second or third bulk pre-clipped.
Yeah. So, yeah. But they would target, yeah, and they must say it to everyone, I assume.
Depends how good you are at knee barring. Maybe if you can get that knee bar in really well,
yeah,
you could clip.
I did hear, we maybe spoke about it, Billy Wydell bet Max Milne 500 quid that you couldn't chalk up on the first like drop in between the undercuts.
Oh, yeah.
That would be hard, to be fair. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I heard that Mal could have done that.
Oh, really? Mm. You see, I love these little like whispers in the climbing community.
I also heard that you have to be carried up to the base of the cliff to try the route because he wasn't very well fueled.
Yeah, I've heard that.
that's excellent for our Careless Whispers section there.
Yeah, there you go. Do you first round and first minute and biography main things on the horizon for you then?
Yeah, I think the next year first round is probably going to be the focus. And another goal of mine has been to flash 8C, which has probably been my main goal for this year, which has been a really cool experience, actually. I think
it takes a very different head game to Red Point, right?
Yeah, definitely. I actually feel like, although I've not actually achieved it, I've had some of my best climbing performances ever, like on these flash attempts. I'm in the best shape that I've been, and I've climbed better than I ever have before. I've been nice and relaxed and climbed with good movement.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I'm still working on it.
Yeah, it's a psychology behind flashing something quite radically different to... I guess you don't know the moves, so it's always going to be like you have to be quite relaxed and intuitive, I suppose.
Yeah. But with these routes I've been trying to flash, I've known every single handhold and foothold before I set off the ground. So I know the route like the back of my hand. I've been putting like quite a lot of effort into chatting to a lot of people, climbing a lot of the other routes in the same sector. So I've got a feeling for the movement, watching as many videos as I can. So most of the time when I set off, I do know exactly what I'm doing because I don't think I have any hope in onsighting an AC, but I think flashing's a little bit different.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Have got any lined up?
I did have a bit of a list, but I've kind of exhausted all of them and dropped most of them.
That's the thing with flashing, like... Yeah. It's not timeless, is it? You can't go back.
Yeah.
I'll just give it for my second flash gear.
What's the process like with flashing a hard boulder? Is it, I guess it's similar. You're like learning, you're going into a lot of detail about with the beta.
Yeah. I've never actually spent any time focusing on it. The things that I would flash, I don't think I've ever like really... Have I really gone into boulders? I don't know if I've ever gone on a trip and been like, I want to give good flash goes on these things. I've never really put much time. The times when I flash hard things, and I haven't flashed that much. Basically, when I pull on a climb, any boulder, I'm usually I like to have a plan just when I climb anyway. I'll look at all the holds, and if I can feel the holds from the ground, I'll feel them, and I'll kind of do everything I can anyway, but like to have as detailed a plan when I climb.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, and it's, I think it's a good indicator that it's never been that important because I'm like never really disappointed when I don't flash something. But yeah, I guess it's a similar thing, but there's a lot less moves to remember.
Yeah, but I think it's easier because there's more room for error because the moves are a little bit easier. I think with bouldering, it's like harder to get things right first go essentially.
Yeah, you have to maybe like the nuances of the plan.
But I think that has made me better at red pointing as well. Like you say, you always like to have as much information as you can, and it means you can get things done much quicker. So I've kind of taken that approach onto doing some like quick red points, which I've been getting better at this year as well. Try and work out your own beta and stop relying on what other people have done, because that's something that's happened to me a bit. If I watch all these videos, I forget to explore different options.
Yeah, you're like, this must be the way because everyone else has done it this way kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah, no, I usually in like the working phase would be quite experimental. I don't really get sucked into what other people have done. I'll try other things. But once I've like committed to a sequence and I have all this information about each of the moves, I then make an active effort. yeah, get to a point where like I can climb in a way that my body almost has access to that information, but like it's not like an explicit dialogue going on in my head with all these like cues of what to do. It feels a bit more.
Yeah, nice. And how did it feel when you climbed Alpha? Were you conscious, or did you manage to tap into that flow state?
Yeah, I think there was probably a couple of times in Switzerland where I had that flow state. And that was really obvious. I couldn't really have told you how hard I was trying. I really remember like a different time back in spring when I first tried it, when I high pointed and I got the last handhold and there's a hard foot transition. And I remember just thinking the friction on these holds is bad right now. Like, I do not have chalk on my fingers. Yeah, this does not feel very good, basically. Yeah. There was like hesitation there and a load of, obviously I fell off. But yeah, I didn't have a moment where like I even thought anything to myself when I was climbing on an outfit. Felt pretty effortless. Which was quite a nice feeling. Like not only did I have, it was like my body knew what it was doing. It wasn't like I was really engaged with how it felt. So it was kind of just like doing its thing until I stood over the lip. And then I was tensed up. I had that a couple of times when I did the sit to Vecchio late in the trip as well. I had that, you do all the hard climbing, get to a really easy top out, and it looks like the most ugly climbing you've seen.
You kind of wake up, don't you?
Your head's all over the place. No, it's definitely quite noticeable. But I always feel sport climbing, to get into that state for a prolonged amount of time must be, especially when you have to take rest, must be quite an intense experience.
Yeah, I think that's something I'm trying to learn at the moment, is how to get to a rest and relax. Because you can be on a rest and shaking out and not really recovering because you're still quite stressed.
Yeah.
So especially when you're using knee bars, I think it's really important to learn to trust the knee bar and sink into the knee bar and really just chill out, bring your heart rate down, chill your thoughts out a little bit.
Yeah, but then you have to be able to tap straight back into that.
Yeah. I don't think I really get into that state where I'm not thinking. I think usually with some of my best ascents, I am still conscious, but I judge myself less in a way. So the thoughts are still there, but I don't. They kind of go in one ear and out the other, or I think about them for a moment and then they sort of pass on.
And you don't engage with them.
Don't engage with them. For example, when you talked about the slightly like damp fingers, maybe you feel that, but you don't think, oh, my fingers are damp, I'm going to fall off. It's like, oh, my fingers are damp. And then you forget about it. The next move comes and you don't let those thoughts get to your head.
Yeah,
I think that's what goes wrong on routes for me sometimes, is maybe you make a mistake or something doesn't feel right, and then you get super stressed. But usually the successful ascents are when you just let those things pass.
So the key word there was hesitation, wasn't it? Because Aidan, when you say you had that feeling on Alpha and you then hesitated, and you're like, that's the worst thing you can do when climbing is spend longer in a position that you've only just got. Whereas like, as you would say, Buster, if you feel like, oh, I don't feel good, but you're already moving through it, if you sit in the next hold, you're not in that position anymore. So, as long as you keep moving, then your chances are okay. But it's the moment you stop and you think, oh, no, I've not got it.
Yeah, it's like a very meditative state. It's kind of like very analogous to trying to meditate, isn't it? Letting go.
I'm glad you said it, because, I remember that, trying to meditate one time, which has never worked. But I remember someone
that one time?
No, I tried a few times, but I'm just hopeless. I can't turn my brain off at all. But they say to you, don't they, like, you know, you let the thoughts come and then just acknowledge them and then just let them drift away. And I never managed to get the drift away bit, but
just all build up.
Yeah. Then just another one comes in and then they're like, you're shit at meditating, God, suppressing down your head. But yeah, it's exactly the same thing they say for that.
Yeah.
That's been hard with trying to flash at my limit, because you kind of know what you're doing, but you don't really know what to do. But I can't stop and think about it, because if you stop and think about it, it's all over. So you've got to keep committing. And I think there's been like four or five routes where I've done most of the hard climbing and I've come off like an easy to medium move. And that's because like you've sort of just got to go for it there and then in the and yeah, make that decision really quickly. And like you say, as soon as you start to hesitate, then it's all over and you're sat on the rope.
Yeah.
As soon as what's happened, and then you just, it's over.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's a weird, it's like a, it is a weird balance of, you can't completely disengage with those thoughts because you've never been on the move. So they are somewhat relevant as well. Like, yeah, challenge, flashing.
Yeah, sometimes better to commit to bad beta rather than hesitate and come up with better one. Yeah, because you just don't have time.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice. We have a couple more Patreon questions.
Yeah, should we do a couple of Patreon questions?
First one of which was, who were your early inspirations? You spoke a little bit about Moon and Wolfgang.
Yeah, but, like all those old school guys, Ben, Jerry, Johnny Dawes.
No, he probably saw him around London a bit as well, right? Was he?
I think I only met him. I met him a few years ago. Maybe he wasn't climbing or living in London at the time. But yeah, I was really inspired by all of those guys from the 80s and 90s. And then the hitman, Liam Halsey, as well.
Mm. Yeah.
I always really looked up to him and my other coach at the time, Rob, and climbing with Molly a lot. And I was climbing with those three quite regularly. So, and I found that quite inspiring and the people I looked up to.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Mm. That was a good scene. It was a good era of that. A good Westway community.
Sure. This patron question might end early, so I'll ask the first part of it and see if it's going to be worth asking the second part of it. But do you work with any young climbers?
So I do work with a few. I definitely find it very different. It's definitely a little bit more work than working with adults in some ways, but it's really satisfying, really enjoyable.
Really? Have you ever had to introduce them to climbing outside, or is that something they've kind of done themselves?
I've never done that.
Yeah, okay. That's where that Patreon question probably ends. But in which case, I'll switch it slightly to, like, you say it's different to working with adults. Like, what way?
I think they've got less preconceived ideas about training and about what's right and what's wrong, and they're more open to learning, more open to suggestion.
Mm.
And it kind of in some ways it's easier to fit things around their life because it's a little bit more simple, there's less going on. But then at the same time, I often chat to their parents as well, and then that adds like another element. So,
and do you have any boulder projects at all, or are you all route focused?
I'd love to do some more bouldering. I was going to go to Switzerland. That was the plan for after I'd done action, but I looked at the forecast and it looked really warm, but then Will and it didn't seem to stop, Will and Aidan.
It was quite hot. The start of the trip was like, we had mid-20s.
Yeah. I'd really like to get there, and there's so much on the grit I'd like to do as well.
Anything in particular?
Careless Talk. That's an obvious one.
Classic.
The ace as well. Super Block. Some of those like proud classic lines.
Yeah. Yeah. We best get ourselves over there as well.
I looked at it when I was there. I looked at it from a distance. I didn't go all the way over there, but that's the step one, isn't it?
You need to have like a lot together to try those taller things, like enough people there with pads and the right kind of people around you, I guess.
Yeah, not one to do by yourself.
Although some people have, but yeah.
There were other like history climbs as well, aren't there?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You can also try some of your boulder problems as well, Aidan. I don't know how the lakes is in the winter. I guess it's pretty hit and miss with the weather.
Yeah, the last little spell has been very rainy, actually. Since I got back from Switzerland, I haven't really climbed outside. It's been very, like, yeah, wet. But you can definitely get dry days, and generally there's a bit of a breeze. So if there is a dry day, often the mountainous stuff will dry quickly, but also be flipping cold. You can climb that all year round, and stuff like at Carrick is often better if you get dry days around this time of year.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have both been away, but the conditions in the UK have been awful for months. You know, it's rained for basically every day of November, but before that it was really hot. Warm.
Yeah.
And muggy. Yeah, it's been terrible for ages.
Yeah, it's just getting it all out of the way before some crack in December's conditions. Yeah.
Maybe.
Nice.
Well, I think things on the more importantly, some boulders on the scoreboard I still got to do.
Have you? I thought you'd done everything. Or almost.
I think Bosey and Jim have added a couple of things, and I've never done. I think you did it recently. The one that Jerry does, fill the pinch. Oh,
yes, I did that recently. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh yeah, you get the little drag pocket with the pinky around the side.
Yeah.
I do actually know that one.
You'll hate it. You'd hate that, Aiden. It's like a moonboard problem.
You take your other arm off and
yeah. It's like no rock climbing ever. But it's like a party trick board problem.
I can get training for it, you know.
Yeah. Have either of you tried any of the like harder ones on the moonboard? I tried the Daniel Woods boulder, Black Beauty.
Oh, that's
a couple of days ago.
Nails, I've seen that. Yeah. I've seen that one before. Yeah. It does like a really hard move from like a undercut and like a vertical pinch.
Yeah, desperate.
Absolutely desperate.
I actually on the wooden set, I did the like introduction moonboard masters thing for that wooden set. So I had a bit of a session on there. I remember it just being naff because of Adam Timonov set a 1-2-3 dino on it and nobody could touch it. I was so grumpy.
That's the problem with those like thing where everyone sets the hardest they can is basically no one climbs anyone else's problems, and quite often they don't climb their own problem either.
Yeah. I did just about get myself up my own, but
I've got kind of a last question for you, Buster. With all the work you've done with like loads of other people, so much of the time you've put in like reading up about training in general, is there anything that you think now that you got really wrong when you were younger training? Is there anything, any like big mistake you made?
Yeah, my thoughts and opinions on things are like often changing with experience, and also like as new research comes out. So I think it's I try to be pretty open and not get too dogmatic about things, like what's right and what's wrong. I think something which I regret or I didn't really do much of when I was younger was a lot of bouldering and basic strength training. So I was almost exclusively climbing on routes, like doing a lot of various different intervals, like doubles, triples, 4x4s, single hard routes. And I never really went bouldering. And I think I missed out a lot there in terms of learning movement and getting strong whilst I was younger.
There are so many more good training modalities now, and like loads, like really, loads of work's been put in. But I still think the best training for climbing is climbing.
Oh, for sure.
Which is funny, isn't it? Because like people spend less and less time doing it because of more time training.
Yeah, I think my training off the wall just gets simpler and simpler all the time, and then my training on the wall becomes like more specific and more complex as time goes on as well.
That really resonates with the detail and quality of stuff on the wall. Kind of like picks up the slack of the complexity I think there's wisdom in that.
And I think as climbers a lot of climbers are trained quite hard these days, but relatively we're not very well trained when it comes to resistance training and that sort of thing. So actually just doing really simple stuff with weights and with fingerboarding has a lot of benefit, and then we can spend more time focusing on what we do on the wall.
Mm.
Awesome.
Sweet.
That's great. Thanks so much, Buster. That was great.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, no, I appreciate
it. Nice to chat to you guys.
Yeah, really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, nice one. I'll catch you guys soon.
Yeah, good luck on the journey back.
Cheers. Yeah, I'm actually planning to stop off and try one more ACT flash on the way, so I've got to get that done in the morning.
Wow, yeah, you gotta be efficient there.
Well, good luck, bud.
Yeah, nice, great one. To speak to you.
Awesome. To see you guys.
Thanks, mate. Man. See ya.